Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. I'm your co-host, Ron Edwards, coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, beginning to become the winter wonderland, if you will. Woo! Windchill's about 2 below 0 right here this evening. And the Twin Cities, if you will, the capital of liberalism and tolerance and et cetera, according to the Chamber of Commerce. We have a number of issues we want to take a look at tonight. As we speak, we assume that the meeting has probably ended, though it could possibly be going on. And we will be taking a look tonight at the request by the former group ACORN, who now goes by the name of the neighborhood organization, talking in terms that we need less police in the city of Minneapolis. Minneapolis is a city of now over 400,000. It sounds great for people to say that, though I don't think they're going to stand the post, if you know what I mean. For those of you in the military, you know just what I mean. But anyways, we want to start on an interesting note in this Yuletide season, if you will. My colleague and co-host, Mr. Allen, who has been gone for a month, if you will, working on some academic issues and being creative and et cetera, was supposed to have returned tonight. He will not be with us, and so consequently we will not be able to take telephone calls. Of course, those that have the number will be able to certainly text me, and we will try to answer any of the specific questions that you have. But we have to talk in terms that the grunge is out here in Minnesota. You know, we're not supposed to talk about these kinds of things here in the liberal north, if you will, in the land of Humphrey and McCarthy and folks like that. But in the last week, the Mall of America, identified by their initial MOA, started an effort way back in the summer of this year and kept it very quiet, but moved about the country attempting to find a black Santa Claus, someone that really knew how to carry out the role of Santa Claus, St. Nick, St. Nicholas, if you will, and et cetera. And lo and behold, at a Santa Claus convention in, of all places, Bronson, Missouri, one of the country western capitals of America, along with Nashville, they found a single black Santa Claus, a gentleman who is a veteran of the armed forces of the United States, if you will. He actually resides in the Dallas, Texas area and has actually been carrying out the role of a Santa Claus for quite some time, and so he is well-versed. Well, the Mall of America moved ahead. They did something very interesting because they unfortunately knew that there could be negatives, if you will. But what they did is set up a new photo operation where, you know, you, for a fee and purchase of the pictures, could get your child's picture and yourself and whoever else taken with Santa Claus, if you will. And things have been going very, very well. In fact, in our local newspaper here, just 2 days ago, there was a nice story about the black Santa Claus, if you will. I was brought up in a good Christian home, and I was brought up to understand that Santa Claus was Santa Claus because I had some pretty sophisticated grandparents and parents, if you will, and I learned at a very, very, very early age. It wasn't the pigmentation, if you will. It was the message of love and facilitation that was being delivered. But I've known over the years, and by the way, for those that are new and just joining us, this commentator is 77 years of age. So I've been here a long time, and of course it's been a long time since I've sat on Santa's lap, if you will. But in those 77 years, I have learned very forcefully, if you will, and with great appreciation that it is what is in the heart and what the symbol represents, and certainly Santa Claus represents happiness. and a message during the Yuletide season and a separate, and probably most importantly to anybody, to the children, because that's who really it's about. In fact, in the picture, in the edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, there's a young white child, and he is smiling, and you can tell that he is very happy as he is looking at the camera, and you can sense that he feels the comfort, if you will, and the blessing that represents St. Nicholas, Santa Claus, if you will, many other different names. And so I was somewhat sad about 3 days ago here in our beloved liberal Minnesota that folks, I tell you, folks use that social media. most of them are cowards, but they use it to the nth degree, if you will. And they began to write postings. Now, you know, you got to be careful nowadays because the providers of the services will take you off of the Facebook, internet, website, et cetera. In some cases, you may not ever get back on, and you'll have to do like General Flynn's son did, come up with a different name, a bogus name, and things like that. But the attack was unmerciful, if you will. And in fact, the African-American gentleman, who is a veteran of the United States Armed Forces, so he certainly more than earned the right to take on a mystic, if you will, character called Santa Claus, who's, you know, been around for a couple hundred years, if you will. And he clearly takes great pride in what it is that he does, the mission that he serves, and the happiness that he brings to the children that are a part of his quote-unquote mission, responsibility, and et cetera. But man, I'm telling you, folks up here in the Twin Cities, folks started sending statements that represented blasphemy, if you will. They tried to call the brother everything but the walking black dog of Satan, if you will. They said it was outrageous that Santa Claus is a white character, is that a negro has no business that under any circumstances on God's green earth, if you will, though they themselves don't know the color of God. In fact, they don't even get the color of Jesus right. But, you know, so much for that conversation for another day in another monastery, if those of you that are true students of religion know what I'm talking about, where I'm going. And, of course, many have come to the defense. The first couple of days was absolute sellouts. Saturday was about three-fourths. It picked up because he was only under contract for 4 days. It was something the Mall of America wanted to test. And what better area than to test it in good old Minnesota? I mean, what like was in Mississippi or Louisiana, South Carolina, or Texas, where the gentleman, in fact, resides and lives. In comfort and et cetera. And so people have been trying to figure out what it was that has caused such a venom. And on my television program that airs here in the Twin Cities on Sunday afternoons at 5 on MTN, I have said one of the things that's just has happened to us is that we just have a terrible, terrible existence of meanness. We've become a very mean-spirited nation for whatever reason. There's a level of hatred, disdain, and disrespect, and et cetera, and that's really too bad because sometimes that's not a good sign. Again, for those of you that are scholars of religion, if you will, the scriptures and et cetera, there are warnings contained in the Holy Book that indicates that at some point in time in man's existence upon this planet, there may be a situation of final irritation with the person, the entity, if you will, that makes all of this work, if you know what I mean. And so it is with sadness that we see this, if you will, but Mall of America will be indicating that it was a success, that there were many, many happy children. There were many beautiful pictures taken of these children and Santa Claus, if you will. I don't know until the child's mind has been poisoned. It's not until normally a child is 7 or 8 years old that their minds are poisoned with regards to race and et cetera. But I'm just not sure that a 4, 5, 6, well, let me go back, a 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 year old cares about the color of the guy in the red suit, if you will, with that beautiful white beard, if you will. That child is concerned that their voice and the message that they're delivering to this person, this Santa Claus, this St. Nicholas, is being heard and that they will receive rewards for being good. Think about that, my friends, for being good children, for doing everything that mommy and daddy said to do, from drinking their milk and eating the cereal, if you will, and getting fairly decent grades and et cetera, and that they are going to be rewarded. That's what a child thinks about. And if a Santa is on top of their game, if you know what I mean, and knows how to speak with the child and leave a child with a sense of comfort and, most importantly nowadays in this country, safety, the sense of safety and et cetera, and that child, upon completion of that conversation, if you will, that blessed moment, yes, it is a blessed moment because the child is happy, and basically in 95% of the cases that I've seen happen and I know that studies are done, parents are happy too. In fact, because it was by appointment, if you will, and have the picture taken and et cetera, I don't think there was a single parent of the hundreds and hundreds that came into Mall of America, into the special sections, into the photographic room and et cetera. I don't think they would have put their child in harm's way. And I think that they would have had every early signal, early indication if that child was terrified of that figure in that red suit, whose color was not the rosy pink red of Santa Claus that they had been told about. What they were really looking at was the softness of the voice, the tenderness, if you will, the understanding of what a child was asking for. Probably that, and by the way, as I said, this gentleman, this man, again, a member of the United States Armed Forces, serving his nation and et cetera, who had actually been interested in playing Santa Claus since the death of his father when he was 12 or 13 years old with his other siblings and et cetera. And then after he came out of the Armed Forces of the United States, he decided that being a Santa Claus was what he would like. And as I said at the top of this particular reflection, he was found by MOA. He was located at a Santa Claus convention in Bronson, Missouri, if you will. He was the only black Santa Claus there. And I guess the reason is that so many of us of the African-American persuasion feel oftentimes the burden, if you will, the anger, if you will, the hatred, if you will, of roles that we would try to take on that some white folks feel that's a white man's role. And yet, let me take you to a place called Hollywood. And how many of you in my age group, and as I said before, I'm 77 years of age, how many times did I watch white men play Indians? You know, they didn't even call them Native Americans or indigenous people. In movies, how many times did I watch individuals play the roles of black men and black women and et cetera? And the rationale was is that it was a privilege that they some way or another had earned by virtue of the fact that they were white and they could play the role of anybody, if you will, regardless of irrespective of color of skin, race, creed, national origin. I remember when Anthony Quinn, this takes y'all back a ways, was picked by Hollywood to play the role of Toussaint, L'Enfant Toussaint, the great leader of Haiti, if you will, the only man of color in the history of the Caribbean to stand up and fight the oppression of the white slave masters and drove the French out of Haiti, if you will. By the way, to this day, the Haitians still pay the price for being the only populace on that island, if you will, share it with the Dominican Republic, of standing up and taking on the powerful French, a modern, quote-unquote, back in those days, the 1700s. And yet, I remember the controversy. I remember Ebony Magazine and Jet Magazine writing some interesting editorials about, you know, what qualified Anthony Quinn from playing that kind of role. But, you know, I've seen Jeff Chandler played any number of great Native American leaders, primarily always Apaches, if you will, Mescaleros, and et cetera. How many times have we as black people seen that? How many times have we seen the twisting of history and et cetera, particularly as it pertains to role playing and the making of money and et cetera? But anyways, tonight here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis, I think there's a certain softness coming from the far north, if you will, coming from the household of jolly old Saint Nicks. An image, a legend, a mystic, if you will, that many of us who were children, who certainly were not abused, disrespected, and et cetera, grew up with, having an appreciation and a love. As I said at the top of this particular reflection, discussion, editorializing, that I was taught and shown early on in the process that there were black Santas, that black Santa was a combination of the imagination of what it was you thought you saw when you snuck down those steps to see what was under that tree. And there were many African Americans, Negroes, and et cetera, contrary to what some dumb historians may try to provide to you as a reality. There were black folks that had two-story, three-story houses, and they had fireplaces, if you will, but if they didn't, they had Christmas trees. You see, a lot of that is being lost in black America, and that is sad, because it does not allow for the narrative to then be placed upon the table of discussion, reflection, and debate, and argue how selfish, how sinister, how mean-spirited it is to attempt to destroy a child's dream of that which they have great expectation for that short period of time that they are a child. At every holiday called Christmas, there will be moments of happiness. There will be cheer. And under that tree, there will be presents which say to them as children that their parents are showing them their appreciation as their parents for being good, for doing the right thing. It's too bad that that has not, in some way or another, like on a conveyor belt, found its way into the hearts of those who so mean-spiritedly and viciously sent messages to MOA indicating that they were nothing but a bunch of in-loving, you know what the word in means, you know what we're talking about here, that devilish word, that Portuguese word, by the way, and that there is really a deep appreciation. In fact, some of you should just take the time to send a note to the management of MOA, Mall of America, and to the owners, the Masons, and just thank them for attempting to bring a little bit of light and blessing to a nation that, my God, desperately needs it, because we are becoming a very, very mean nation who cannot understand why our children began to emulate us and take on, quote-unquote, the hostility and the meanness that leads to the decadence, to the violence that has become a part of this nation. But again, to MOA, the Mall of America, and to that, the veteran of the United States Army, God bless you. And I think that every child that sat on your lap and had their picture taken with you with the approval of their parents are a little bit richer, those children, are a little bit richer and having an appreciation that we are possibly a society, God knows, a nation, that can maybe at some time come together and be respectful and love and have affection one for the other, irregardless of the color of one's skin. It is emotion. If you hear emotion in my voice, it is real. It is there. To attack any human being from being on a mission to take on a positive role of life and to show such hatred and disdain as has been shown here, we repeat again, but we will not end on that note, that there are people that are so sick, that they are so angry, they are so vile, they are so vicious, they are so filled with poison and venom, that they would attack all that is holy in this so-called society of ours. Again, congratulations to the brother who took on the responsibility, had the courage, and brought joy and love to many young children, a certain majority who were white, though black parents were flocking out there to get their pictures and their children's pictures taken with this. And notice we will not use that word, with this Santa Claus. It's not a black Santa Claus. He was the image of what we like to think is the goodliness and the gaudy of a holiday. Think about it, my friend. Well, as we said earlier, as we move up to the 9 o'clock hour, we'll be going until 9:30 tonight. We are having, or the city is having, a debate, if you will. In fact, in this morning's edition of our major newspaper, if you will, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, there was a headline, "Cops Hiring Plan Draws Fire." Now, here's what's happening this town. Violence, assaults, and things like that are really up. And proportionally, we're right up there with Chicago in the number. We've had now close to 500 people shot. Now, as I said, we're a city of a little over 400,000. Our sister city, St. Paul, has now reached up to just a tad over 300,000. So we're a big metropolitan area, if you will. And yet, in Minneapolis alone, we're now hitting 500 people being shot. We say that, you know, 27 to 28 deaths, you know, we really linger and die, if you will. And we certainly don't talk about, and we do not consider it a homicide unless we're deciding to charge someone. We don't talk about all the people that are ODing here, that are overdosing and dying, if you will. We've got a heroin epidemic here in the Twin Cities, and it is, to say the least, it is of great concern. But anyways, this organization formerly known as ACORN, you remember ACORN, now called the Neighborhood Organization, have been saying that a plan to hire 50 more police officers in Minneapolis, which, by the way, at least probably 5 or 6 of them would have been officers of color. And we desperately need officers of color. And for my listening audience, for anybody that says, well how do you know, how do you follow this, what do you do? Well, I have been and currently actually still am a federal monitor for the Department of Justice. And I've been working for many, many, many years. In fact, I've been involved in lawsuits, both involving the fire department and the police department, to bring about a greater integration. You see, when I was a young student, high school, 1954, '55, '56, and I was going to school, we only had 3 Negro police officers. And in fact, that had been the tradition in this town since 1889, when the first Negro was sworn in as a law enforcement officer here in the beautiful city of Minneapolis. Again, 1889. And in fact, until just before the Second World War, a Negro officer, in fact, by the 1930s, we were down to 2, was not allowed to arrest a white citizen. He had to call a white officer who would come and arrest the white citizen. But I guess after the Second World War, the decision was made, particularly, actually it was made under 1944, under then Mayor Hubert H. Humphrey, if you will, who indicated that was one of the most ridiculous policies that he had ever had knowledge of, and et cetera, in order to stop. And so black officers or Negroes were told that they could arrest white people. Again, there were only two on the force. We didn't increase to three until 1952-53. Stayed three for a number of years. We finally made a major breakthrough in 1960-1961 when we hired three more. And we were up to six or seven, if you will. Though it's ironic because the man who was the chief jailer of jail here, we're a big county, rich county, the man by the name of Earl Combs, Mr. Combs, well-respected man. His wife was the director of the Phyllis Wheatley Settlement House here for over 25 years. Earl Combs had been appointed the chief jailer of the Hennepin County Jail way back in 1927. And he was one of the toughest cats that you'd ever want to see. He was a veteran of the First World War. He was a man not to be messed with, et cetera. And he served as the chief jailer of the Hennepin County Jail for almost over 30 years, and particularly under a legendary sheriff, if you will, named Pat Ryan, who turned out to Mr. Combs. We used to always ask the question in the 1950s, you know, I was a Mr. Combs chief jailer. And think about it. He was the chief jailer at a time when black police officers, the two or three that we had, could not arrest a white man. But Mr. Combs, God bless him, could hold him for as long as he wanted to in custody. And nobody ever figured that out. So this move that has taken place by the neighborhood organization group, formerly known as ACORN, has said that they need the money for a number of kinds of programs. Basically means programs that allow them to hire their friends and et cetera. I'm not sure who's going to stand post. In fact, we said that earlier, because if I was a citizen and paying taxes and et cetera, I am a citizen, but I'm just giving this narrative, if you will. And one of my loved ones, one of my children, were assaulted, robbed, beaten, maybe even unfortunately killed or et cetera. Or my house was broken into and there weren't enough police anywhere to be seen. In fact, one of the great thinkers of this group quoted in this morning's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, said, well, because of technology and et cetera, Minneapolis is growing, and so that means that it's time to reduce the police department. And I said, you see, it's a fool like that they must have put in charge of the Titanic. And he saw the iceberg, and he thought that it was going to shrink. And we all know the history of what happened in the tragedy of the Titanic. Now, there aren't enough boats tonight, and I would be surprised. I will probably receive a call from some colleague after the end of this program. I assume that the nine votes that were present the other day when, as a committee of the whole, and sometimes I wonder if these people who want to be the next millennium, want to be the next leaders to take on the great issues of the day, if they really understand, if they really understand what it is and what it takes, if you will, circumstances, situations, governments, and et cetera, and go beyond civics 101, I don't know sometime if they understand that. And so I studied closely the article in this morning's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, cop hiring plan draws fire. And listen to some of the reflections made by these young new giants, if you will, who were talking in terms of the narrative that they were prepared to set, if you will, and how they will go about the business. And I got to tell you, there's some of them folks, I've looked at them, I've watched them, I've known them, I've seen them, if you will. First of all, I'm not sure that I would want to be in a city without law enforcement and have these people living on the next block. Now, I'm being for real with you, my friends. Particularly when you talk about things like drug trafficking, oops, you know, because these are some of the same people that talk in terms that we need to have free life, free love. Kind of reminds me of the 1960s that really, in some respects, got us into big trouble. People started saying that they were a, you know, flower child and things like that. Oh, yeah, yeah, I come out of that particular era. I watched all of the expressions of profoundness and understanding and greatness and et cetera, and I watched a lot of those folks. In fact, I watched a lot of them who would not stand for the draft, watched them run off to Canada and et cetera, or watched them kind of go into hiding. And then many of them, though, after they came back, shaved and bathed, if you will, put on a suit, and their daddy and their uncles came and got them, patted them on the head, and certainly did not call them, quote-unquote, cowards in defense of their country. And I watched many of them over the years move up through big corporate and et cetera. No one questioned their patriotism. And I said that because it is an issue of patriotism when you start talking about we don't need police. We don't need guardians. Now, by the way, for those that listen, I have been identified and continue to be identified as one of the most severest critics of law enforcement when they don't do right, when they break the rules and et cetera. You have to be there. But even in a situation like that, you better know what you're talking about when you start taking on public institutions, particularly those that provide public safety, so that you and your family can feel safe, if you will, be you living in Minneapolis or living out of Minneapolis or in St. Paul and et cetera. And it is sad to see the play that is being made because it comes at a time when it will be election 2017. And I really hope that the current incumbent mayor of our city, who has come under attack for some things, if you will, none of us are perfect, none of us will ever be perfect, is that she will not be intimidated. It appears that the city council, which is under the leadership of a very, very tough lady by the name of Barb Johnson, whose mother, and she comes from a very political family, Barb does the Rainvilles. Barb Johnson's mother was a great teacher to her. Her mother served as city council president. And they're the kind of ladies that ask some real, real tough questions of you when you start talking in terms of change. Now, I'm all in favor of change. I mean, my God, if we hadn't had change, we wouldn't be looking at TV and tinkering with our iPhones sometimes to the extent that we, you know, not looking where we're driving, not in some cases not even looking where we're walking and et cetera. I mean, change is important. That's what it's all about. That's why when I hear Donald Trump's people and others talking about change in America, I have a pretty good idea of what they're talking about, if you will. I have a pretty good idea of what kind of change they're talking about. They're talking about the change of Simon Legree, if you will, in the days of slavery and et cetera. I mean, I get that understanding when folks start talking about we need to go back to the good old days, we need to change back to what it used to be like in America and et cetera. And I'm thinking, okay, all right. Well, one of the things that new change would bring about is that we'd have a lot of American corporations with a lot of free labor, and a lot of black people wouldn't be getting compensated and paid, and once again, we'd be way behind the curve. I mean, way, way, way behind the curve. And so I'm understanding all of this as I listen to it. Now, this also comes at a time when these proponents, quote-unquote, we need less and less and less police, have also been needing and trying to figure a way out to pick up about $1 million in money, program money, that had been applied for by the city of Minneapolis and by the mayor and et cetera to deal with, unfortunately, the problem of gang violence, youth at risk, and et cetera. And I've watched closely. I see so many of them talking in terms of their knowledge about what is happening, but I have to tell you, folks, a number of years I have been a part of, unfortunately, regrettably, a special unit, a special detail that of civilians who go out to the crime scenes when a life has been lost, if you will, and who interact with families and et cetera, who, with all respect and deference, allow you to interact with them. And I can't even begin to tell you, in fact, none of your business, really, for me to tell you how many times I have had to work with families who have lost their loved ones, if you will. I've seen families lose their beloved daughters, their sons, and et cetera. And one of the things that amazes me about these are people I never see. I never see them on the scene. I never see them out there. I never see them doing this doggone thing to bring aid and comfort and compassion to those that are feeling the pain of tragedy, if you will. But, man, I've watched them stand up at city council meetings over at the state capitol, and I've watched them rail and et cetera. I've also watched them represent incorrect and inconsistent historical facts as they talk. And so a week ago, I was invited, though I was well aware of it, to a meeting that it was actually being carried out by John Jay College of Criminal Investigation and Law, John Jay. Big, prestigious college there in New York City, if you will, making a lot of money on community misery, really. Oh, they will tell you that, you know, they're really trying to help out these poor, ignorant people, primarily blacks and et cetera. And I sat in a meeting for about 2 hours, and it was talked down to by a woman, white woman, who had come here. Actually, she lied, was not consistent with how long she really been here. She'd been coming back and forth into Minneapolis working with a number of organizations, but primarily the MPD, that's the Minneapolis Police Department. And I'm looking at the material. I'd already seen it earlier in the summer. And I keep looking at this material, and they have programs. They have a program called GVI, Gang Violence Initiative, if you will. People make a lot of money off the misery of people of color, if you will, and in the inner cities and et cetera, they really make a lot of money off black folks, if you will. And this program that John Jay College is involved with is in places like Boston, Chicago, Kansas City, then Indiana, Minneapolis, if you will, Chattanooga, Tennessee, and some other cities. And so, for about a year and a half, I have been researching, analyzing, and utilizing my contacts, if you will, to find out just how effective their operations have been. Well, the fact of the matter is it hasn't been very effective, particularly in places like Chicago, where they will kill more folks by the end of this year than at any time in 20 years, if you will. And so some of the people that are talking about less police, if you will, tonight in a town hall meeting in downtown Minneapolis at the City Hall are some of the same people that I see moving in a clandestine manner about in the community, doing all kinds of illegal and illicit things, particularly the selling of drugs. Some way or another, some of these folks have been told that this is one of the more lucrative economic bases that you want to be a part of, selling dope in your community, if you will. But the other part that has come out now is the new medicating. Oh, yes, yes, yes. And we've seen this before. In fact, we as the sons and daughters of the African have oftentimes been used as the experiments, if you will, for white medical research. I refer you, as we did last week, to a couple of Pacific books, the book The River and the book Medical Apartheid, one by Dr. Washington, Medical Apartheid, the other one by Mr. Hooper. 10 years of research in that situation. The River basically talking in terms of HIV, the experimenting on millions and millions of black Congolese and others in the immediate area, Burundi, Rwanda, Tanzania, and et cetera. And so I'm in this meeting last week at the Urban League of Minneapolis, and I'm listening to this Caucasian woman talking down to us. She basically, her presentation was at about a fifth grade level. So unfortunately, she made a lot of mistakes because there were people in there that had significant experience of both life and education. But she got so carried away with her presentation, she said, and these people that we will be going into their homes, and we will be going in with the police, the probation officer, a member of the prosecutor's office. We'll take a couple of black ministers and community people, and we will go in and we will tell them the table shall end and must end their criminal activities and et cetera, et cetera. And so later in the meeting, I mean, it got kind of testy in there, and one of our longtime activists, a brother by the name of Spike Moss, has been out here for a long time fighting the battle, just went off, and rightly so, with regards to the disrespect that was being shown. But as you read the material, you were saying, my God, this sounds like another Tuskegee experiment. See, for those of you that don't know Tuskegee, I'm not talking about Tuskegee Airmen, 1942. I'm talking about the Tuskegee experiment at the Tuskegee Veterans Hospital in Tuskegee, Alabama, where black men were infected, thousands were infected with syphilis, which probably reduced our population, according to all statistical data and the mathematicians, by about 725,000 over a period of 50 years. In fact, if it had not been for a white physician and scientist and researcher in Rochester, New York, the government had basically hidden the fact that to use this experimental kind of operation. In fact, it was really the genesis that the Nazis, oh yes, listen closely, my friend, that the Nazis used upon their return from the United States in 1937 after reviewing the Tuskegee Project, if you will. And that is what put them in a position to begin experimental medicine upon the so-called inferiors of the fatherland, which included Jews, if you will, included gypsies, if you will. It included what used to be a very small black African population from the Eastern African colonies of Imperial Germany, a time before the First World War. Now, that population was wiped out pretty quick by 1938. All quote-unquote black Africans in Nazi Germany had been exterminated, if you will, to purify, if you will. And so we remembered that. And then when the whole HIV situation came up, and the United States government participated in the infection of millions and millions of Congolese and others by using polio vaccine in pill form, if you will. And I thought that, oh, and we said it on last week's program. You see, we actually were setting this up last week because we wanted to see just how quiet our leadership would stay and how long they would stay quiet, and they did. They didn't disappoint me, unfortunately. Everyone quiet. Everyone just talking about, give us the money. Give us the money. Yeah, we're going to go out here and work with the gangs. Let me tell you something. For those of you on the domestic scene, the local scene here in the Twin Cities, and particularly in Minneapolis, most of y'all are terrified of those young men and women who look just like you. You're terrified of them. In fact, some of you sit around in your clubs, and I'm talking about your card clubs and your social clubs and et cetera, and you talk about them just like you on the plantation with Massa, those people and et cetera. But you don't understand that when the planners come together to talk in terms of genocide and another stage of genocide, if you will, like Tuskegee, like HIV, like drugs, if you will, like we pretend like we can't figure out who's bringing all the narcotics into America and making sure that it's properly disseminated and distributed in the African-American community. And then we cannot understand why our health condition that it is. I'm talking about our universal health as a race of people, if you will. Have you ever stopped and thought, we said it also last week for the purpose of reflection, have you ever wondered in a country with with the wealth that we have and with the institutions of medical care. We saw it happen for just a brief moment during the Ebola, except they started getting concerned that white folks were going to be infected, if you will. And Ebola, which is actually a quote-unquote derivative of the HIV virus. Oh, you've got to read the book, The River, if you can find a copy. It's 900 and some pages. It's actually 1,000 pages, 1,002 pages. You need to get a better understanding because, as we said to you last week on this program, as we move into the last 15 minutes, 14 minutes of tonight's program, the plan is afoot. This plan actually was first brought forward by a man who now heads up one of our more powerful but lucrative foundations, who was the former mayor for 12 years in this city, who in a speech to the Conference of Mayors in 2009 talked in terms of how he had put together a special committee in 2003 of white corporate types and et cetera to help him create and craft a better program and a better plan for dealing with the colored problem, if you will. It's kind of remindful of National Socialism / Nazism, talking in terms of dealing with the Jewish problem. But when the Nazis used to talk about the ethnic and racial problem, it wasn't only the Jews that they were talking about. You just get that from movie pictures and et cetera. The Nazis went after everybody that was not of pure Aryan blood, if you will. That's why it's so dangerous what is happening. And I notice there hasn't been any discussion today about Mr. Spencer, the Caucasian who is now identifying himself as the new Gruppenführer and support and at the quote-unquote hindquarters of the current president-elect of the United States, the all-right, the ultra-right. We knew them coming up in the 1950s and 60s for what they really were. The terrorists, the right-wing terrorists, if you will, who blew up black churches, killed little black girls, killed young black boys, killed black people, and were actually the forerunner of the Knights of the White Chameleon, the Ku Klux Klan, and et cetera. But because we have so few historical platforms, colleges, and et cetera, we are being pushed further and further away from our history and the dangers that confront us as the sons and daughters of the African. And that is so sad. And so as I sat there in the Urban League last week and listened to this fifth grade level presentation, and the woman really never paid any attention to the fact that there were some angry black folk in there, primarily black women. I have to say the black women who were there were extremely angry, but she wouldn't have given much credence to it because it is black women in city government, particularly in the health department, who are helping to promote this. And it is really a shame before God, if you will, and et cetera, that this kind of conduct. In fact, let me do this. I've received a text message. Someone is saying, please, Mr. Edwards, would you identify who it is you're talking about? You know, folks always need you to authenticate what it is you're saying as a black person about the comings and goings. And what I'm going to do on this program, if you will, I assume we're still on the air. This is being put together, as we said before, by John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And actually, it was launched in 2009. No one in this town has figured out that it was launched at the same time when the then mayor of this city, working closely with a special commission, a secret commission put together in 2003, who made a recommendation in 2007 to how to deal with the Negro problem. It is under the auspices of the National Network for Safe Communities, if you will. Now, there are many of you out there who know this particular group, and you know the history, by the way, of the director and principal, quote-unquote, facilitator, if you will, David M. Kennedy, of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, if you will. And they talk in terms of how they put their actions together to to end violence in the major cities, if you will, and recently implemented procedures and et cetera. And they talked in terms of, and get this, had the audacity to include and say that there was an 18% reduction in homicides in Chicago, and nearly 25% reduction in New Orleans, a 29% reduction in Oakland, and a 55% reduction in Stockton, California, among other cities. Cities such as Detroit, Philadelphia, and Kansas City have begun to use the approach. Baltimore will launch this year. The state of Connecticut is supporting the approach in New Haven, Bridgeport, and Hartford, and smaller cities like Peoria, Chattanooga, and South Bend. Now, to show you how ridiculous it was with this statistical data in which the federal government, our government, gave them significant funding, this is statistical data. I repeat again, the statistical data was from 2007. This woman hands out these documents to a group of 27 African Americans called to what was supposed to be a by invitation only meeting. I had come with a couple of associates who clearly know what is going on in life. And finally, somebody kept looking at the PowerPoint presentation that was being made. You know, folks love to come in and give us PowerPoints. Because one of the undercurrents of disrespect and disdain for black people is that white folks basically maintain that we do not read well, and that our attainment level, achievement level for reading proficiency is about at the sixth grade. So that's why she was giving us a fifth grade presentation. GBI, for those cities that we named, or if it's in your city, particularly, let's say, a city like Chattanooga. In fact, when they talk about the John Jay team, if you will, when they talk about black people in Chattanooga, Tennessee, they maintain that they've never seen a level of concentrated ignorance and functional illiteracy as they have in places. And this is interesting, in places like Chattanooga and places like South Bend and places like Peoria. And it has been interesting what the proposals and the return and the response has been, if you will. And they talk about alternative outreaches and et cetera. But the point that really, well, many points caught my attention that afternoon. Actually, it was morning. It started at 10. She was talking. The woman was talking, and she was talking about these special teams. It's kind of like a military presentation, if you will. These special SWAT teams, these teams that would be going in and bringing order and getting Negroes' minds right about what it is they better do, or they'd be going to the penitentiary, and et cetera. And she slipped up and said, and, you know, we will cut off your cable TV. You know, we will make it tough on your child support and et cetera. We will have you put in jail. And ultimately, this, you know, I said, go ahead on, Big Mama. Caucasian. She said, you will be looking at incarceration, and you will be looking at extermination, if you will. You know, folks were kind of looking at each other, and she said, you know, you could very well find yourself in a situation where you would ultimately be executed. And she forgot where she was, see, because here in our beautiful state of Minnesota, with all our liberalism and with all the other factors that we have to make you disappear, become ill, and et cetera, we don't have capital punishment here in Minnesota. The only way that capital punishment can happen here, if there is a violation of federal law, basically the limits are taking the life of a police officer under color of conspiracy and et cetera, conspiring and et cetera, a federal court can impose death penalty to a case here in Minnesota. But the state of Minnesota, by constitution, no longer renders capital punishment. And she never realized what it was she said until the young sister that is working with her through the Minneapolis Health Department gave her an eye signal, and she probably really didn't know what she had done until after the meeting was over. But she thought she was in Illinois. She thought she was in Tennessee. Thought she was in Missouri, if you will. You know what I'm saying? But it is sad that this operation through the National Network for Safe Communities. And man, I'm telling you, oh, by the way, there's a sub-headline, Saving Lives, Saving Communities. And one of the hallmarks of their relationship and affiliation is working closely with those who move significant amounts of narcotics drugs in through our community, which continues to create the decadence, if you will, and the continued deterioration of our community. So let me repeat the cities that are out there. And remember what I said to you, that the statistical data that these people have been using to get millions and millions of dollars from the federal government, in many cases your tax dollars, if you will, were statistical data from 2007. I thought, well, any organization, you know, be it headed by black folk or particularly white folks, that it, you know, it's they're 9 years behind the curve with regards to getting current data. Because the first thing boss tells a colored person who comes in for employment as we go down to the last minutes is that, you know, you've got to be able to come in with a comprehensive understanding of what your job responsibility, boy or girl, is. But let me name the cities again as we are into the last 3 to 4 minutes of tonight's program. The major hoofah is in the case of Chicago and New Orleans. Those are two of the cities. And the greatest of all was in Oakland, California. And this tremendous number of deaths of African Americans in Stockton, California, and then other cities such as Detroit, Philadelphia, Kansas City, Baltimore, the entire state of Connecticut, out there in Connecticut, they just said, oh, just bring the whole program in there so we can round up Negroes and displace them, dispatch them, and do whatever else. And so the three major cities in Connecticut, we repeat again, New Haven, Bridgeport, and Hartford, and smaller cities like Peoria, Chattanooga, and South Bend. It is a shame, my friends, but it is happening, and it is happening on the watch of so many of our leaders. Well, we are coming to the end of tonight's program. We hope that you are still with us, if you will, and that the NSA has not cut us off. But we do have enough platforms. This commentator, this host, if you will, I have enough platform to continue to get the information out and attempt to serve as a conduit, if you will, of bringing forward the message just how much danger there is that is facing the sons and daughters of the African. And here in my own city, the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, I'm confronted and faced with the fact that this is in fact happening, that it is going on, and that we are, quote unquote, faced with it under the most severest of circumstances. Again, our associate, Mr. Allen, will be returning next week, hopefully. We will have him with us, and we will be able to open those phone lines, and certainly there may be some out there that may want to question and raise questions and have me go back over the master plan for genocide and how it's working across the country and how it's sure working in this city. Again, continue to give you strength in our struggle for survival and salvation. God knows we have been loyal. I hate to use the word obedient, and we have been patriotic to this nation, and yet we have not received anything approaching a just reward. God bless you, Black America, and we will be returning next week. Again, I'm Ron Edwards. This is the Ron and Don Program.